que quepito.
Okay, yeah.
So we do need to be happy to do this big fight. I took it home early to the afternoon. Yeah. To read, but then I realized I can't do anything when I stop.
Me too, I also took it home.
Good morning. Foi amor. Bella. Bangona. Benda. Honorable members. Welcome back from a short visit. Constituency period at the same time. I hope you have had the opportunity to be with your families and also to interact with the constituencies. Family is important. We're back here for this committee and many other committees in Parliament. I think it's going to be the shortest term but the longest at the same time. Because we're going to work long hours. Given the amount of work before us. And I must say, the choice of the first committee meeting in terms of who's coming to present is not by accident. It's because this institution, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, plays an important role in terms of the division of the revenue bill and allocation of resources in the country. And also it does inform to a very large extent the work that we as the Standing Committee on Finance, which is the core responsibility of the committee, particularly along the lines of the fiscal framework, their work has a direct bearing on our interpretation of issues. So we thought it was important as part and parcel of the budget review and recommendation process for Parliament and the committees and the preparation for the medium-term budget policy statement to have a presentation from the Finance and Fiscal Commission, their annual report in particular. But I must also take this opportunity to welcome the acting chairperson Bongani Khumalo and your team. We know that you've got a very, very big responsibility acting and being a creative prop at the same time. So it is not an easy job. But you're welcome to share with us your annual report. I had the opportunity to interact with the previous chair or outgoing chair, Mr. Stein, who has indicated to me that he was going to be leaving. Unfortunately, from our side, we should have had the opportunity to let him present his annual report before he could retire. But we believe that you are part of continuity in that institution and many others that work with you. So and not necessarily the challenges of an individual, the challenges of an individual, and not of a collective. So we want to welcome you and your team, and we're in your hands, basically. Honorable members are very, very eager and fresh to listen to your presentation. We have not taken any other thing before you. So be ready to for a robust engagement from honorable members. Thank you very much, honorable members. Let's allow the acting chairperson to lead and introduce his team. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, for inviting us to come and share with you some of the highlights coming out of our annual report. I am accompanied by Commissioner Tanya Adam on my left here. She is one of the members of the commission that serves the commission on a part-time basis. I must say that she's one of the longer-serving members of the FFC, and I'm glad that I have actually brought her here. So if there are any questions that require contextualizing some of the work of the commission over the years, she will be the correct person to actually field those types of questions, and also to share some of the thinking that the commission currently has in terms of moving forward and responding to some of the changes that have taken place in our government, especially as they relate to service delivery model of government that has been recently introduced. I also have on the left of Tanya, is Mr. Mavuso Pogwana, who is the Chief Financial Officer of the Commission. And on my left, I've got Mr. Mashumi Mzaitume, who is the Secretary of the Commission. And I think there's Henry Exton, whom I think a lot of members would basically know him. He's our parliamentary liaison officer. Chair, if I can go straight to the presentation, I think the commission itself, for those that might not be aware, is a commission that is appointed by the president. But that appointment process of the commission and quite a lot of the work that it does is actually coordinated by the Minister of Finance. The Minister of Finance basically plays the role of creating the link between the Commission and the Presidency. The Commission consists of two individuals, basically on a full-time basis, the Chairperson and the Deputy Chairperson, who are nominated by national government. And then the Chairperson of the Commission, I think, just to confirm what Honorable Mufamadi has indicated, the Chairperson of the Commission also happens to be the Chief Executive Officer and Accounting Officer of the Commission, which does, at some point, create its own problems. We can talk about the experience that we have had, if members should want, and what the thinking at the Commission currently is around that. There are seven other commissioners that serve the commission on a part-time basis. Two are national nominees, three provincial nominees, and another two are nominated by organized local government. And I think at this point in time, organized local government is represented by SALGA. So they are SALGA nominees, basically. At the moment, we have three vacancies at the commission. The chairperson is term expires at the end of August 2010. Then there's a local government nominee whose term expired in June 2009, and there was no appointment to replace them. And then there was an odd situation where invited and accepted the nomination or the appointment, as it were, from the president, but did not pick up the position. So, in fact, that person has never attended a single meeting of the commission. So, we have communicated this to the minister and also to the president for the attention. So, for all intents and purposes, we consider that position to be a vacancy from where we sit. I'm not going to speak to the slide that talks to the vision and mission of the commission. The next slide basically talks about the mandate of the commission. It basically derives from Section 220 of the Constitution, that's Chapter 13. Unlike other institutions supporting democracy in South Africa, which this commission is supposed to be, it is not a Chapter 9 institution. It is actually Chapter 13. But in terms of most of the operations, we basically consider ourselves to be part and parcel of that family of institutions that our constitution established in the quest for supporting democracy. The key enabling legislation basically is the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act of 1997, which was also amended in 2003. There is also the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act that governs the operations of the Commission, especially as they relate to the division of revenue amongst and between and amongst the three spheres of government. There is the Provincial Tax Regulation Process Act, which deals with the issues around the exercise of provincial tax power. And then there's the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act, which deals with the exercise of municipal fiscal powers or tax powers, as it were. There are other pieces of legislation that basically give effect to the Commission in as far as fiscal matters. In most cases, these are dealing with fiscal matters of the Commission. They deal with issues around shifting of functions between organs of state and all of that. So you will find quite a number of pieces of legislation that give effect to the mandate of the Financial and Fiscal Commission. Again, use examples of your Municipal Systems Act, the Municipal Finance Management Act, in as far as it relates to the exercise of municipal borrowing powers, and a piece of legislation that at this point in time, I don't know whether people know about it, is called the Borrowing Powers of Provincial Government Act. It's one of the oldest pieces of legislation which deals with the exercise of provincial powers as they relate to borrowing. Those are some of the few pieces of legislation that I can just mention that that give the effect to the powers and mandate of the Commission. Now, let me just look at some of the key highlights of the Commission, which we have referred to here as achievements. I must say upfront that these achievements are achievements as measured by the Commission in terms of its strategic plan and business plan that actually informs the allocation of revenue that it gets from the fiscal. We have a strategic plan, and we have key areas that we basically say to ourselves, if we don't actually deliver on time on these particular issues, then we will basically fail as a commission to utilize taxpayers' money in a reasonable way. Now, basically, here we count the key submissions that were expected to make by law. We are supposed to table an annual report, which is what we're doing now. We submitted that on time. We are supposed to, 10 months before the minister tables the Division of Revenue Bill, the budget, we are supposed to submit recommendations collections or the division of revenue for that particular year 10 months in advance, and that we did this. Now we're talking about the submission for 2011 division of revenue. We tabled that in May, which was on time as well. Responded to the medium term budget policy statement as required in terms of the money bills, amendment procedure and related matters. Like, we basically managed to do that on time in 2009, and that was basically for the first time that we had to do such a thing. But we had prepared ourselves to do that, and we managed to do that for the 2010 Division of Revenue Bill, which we're supposed to table our submission on the bill itself after the minister has tabled it, and we also did that on time. In terms of the money bills, again, amendment procedure related matters act, we are also supposed to make submissions on the fiscal framework and the appropriation bill and revenue proposal, and we did all of those things, and these were all first time attempts compliance with that particular piece of legislation. Over and above this, the work that the Commission does is quite technical, which informs all of these submissions that we make. And so the Commission, in the pursuit of excellence, also encourages commissioners and staff to publish technical reports in different forums, including accredited academic journals and contributions to books that people write and chapters and all of that, just in the way of contributing to the generation of information on or the knowledge base on intergovernmental fiscal relations issues to the broader community, which is one of the areas that the Commission strives to make a contribution. And that basically we managed to do to quite a, what we consider a satisfactory level. Sub-commissioners and some staff members basically had these publications in quite prestigious journals, and also shared in quite prestigious conferences, made presentations on those. We also, in view of the work that the Commission has done in the past, in 2008, we developed and adopted a new research strategy that basically looked at, and I think for some members that are here might recall a conference, a 10-year review conference that the Commission had way back in 2000, and I think it must have been 2004 if I'm not mistaken. One of the issues that was raised by the then Minister of Finance was for the Commission to relook at its work and identify whether the kind of issues that the Commission, when it was established, were key issues, have been successfully put in place, and if so, what are the next steps in doing that? We looked at that, and we found that in the early years of the Commission, the business was really about getting right the revenue sharing mechanisms. Whether it's your conditional grant, it's your equitable share formula, it's all of those things were quite important at that particular point in time. But over time, those became entrenched in the system. There was a need to, whilst not completely forgetting about them, we consistently review this. There was a need to also stretch the focus, say to extend the focus from those kinds of issues, which we call really first-generation types of issues, to include what we call second-generation types of issues, which relate to the impact of the system on developmental outcomes. And I think this was done before we actually got wind of what government basically was intending to do to its service delivery model, which now turns out to be an outcome-based kind of a delivery model. So in 2008, already we adopted a research strategy, which we began to implement in 2009. I'm very happy, basically, as a commission, to say that this strategy allowed us to adjust quite quickly to the demands that the current delivery model of government basically places on us. We set up budget analysis units in the commission. We set up modeling capacity, and we're also glad to say that the kind of models that the commission is developing are quite world-class types of models that we have been able to share with our international counterparts, and some of our staff basically have been doing these kinds of things and assisting other similar types of institutions. And also, we have been presenting some of these to interested circles within government, and we think that we have basically made a significant stride in terms of that strategy that we adopted. Now, part of the result of that strategy allowed us to basically make within a very short space of time an assessment of what the impact of the global economic crisis has been on the vulnerable sections of our society. I'm talking about both households and businesses. We basically have been able to conduct extensive studies on the impact of the global economic crisis on the economy, and also to make some projections which, from where we sit, I think it will probably be more clear when we discuss our medium-term budget policy submission, that the kinds of projections that the Commission made in terms of where the global economy is going and what the impact on the South African economy was going to be, and therefore how the economy responds to that kind of a shock, we're not very far from what we're actually seeing at this point in time, and we can take pride as a commission in that in being able to do that at least at first attempt, basically, on our implementation of the strategy. I think in terms of the way in which we run and manage our commission, even though we have challenges in certain areas, we still continue to receive unqualified audits from the Auditor General. And in fact, I can say that the Commission has never received a qualified audit report since its establishment. So we still maintain that trend, and 2009-10 was not different from the past years. In terms of the recommendations that we made in 2009 for the 2010 Division of Revenue, we basically are happy to say that the recommendations were also quite warmly received by government. And in the past year, we have actually seen quite a lot of those recommendations being directly utilized by government or utilized as part and parcel of information. I can talk to the review of the provincial equitable share formula in our submission that we made in 2009 for the 2010 Division of Revenue. One of the key issues that we raised there was that we need to go back to basic principles in looking at reviewing the provincial equitable share formula, and that basically requires us to look at expenditure assignments between provinces and national government. And what we needed to do in terms of principle was to clarify beyond what is actually stated in the Constitution. In Schedule 4 of the Constitution just says you are responsible for education, you are responsible for education. It does not say what aspect of education, for example, national government is responsible for, what aspect, except that you can make the point could be a problem in terms of the financing arrangements and the sufficiency of the financing of the resources being allocated. So these were the key issues that we raised. And we then tabled a few options that government could consider in the short term and also in the long term. Government, what we know now is that government has actually reviewed the provincial equitable share formula and have taken a certain position around that for the 2011 division of revenue. And that's something that is currently in discussion at Budget Council and the relevant forum. At a national level, that is, we are still to see what the provincial inputs in that process basically are, but we are quite happy with the way in which the recommendations have been treated around the review of the equitable share formula. In respect to infrastructure investment and social assistance, we also are realizing the onset of the recession and also realizing the fact that government does have a role to play in cushioning the economy and realizing that government still has some space in terms of borrowing, but also realizing that government needed to borrow for the right things. We made recommendations that for the 2010 fiscal year, government should develop and implement comprehensive infrastructure and maintenance strategies, and also should use infrastructure expansion to provide opportunities for people that would basically lose their jobs and those that were unemployed. We also called for a strengthening of the social assistance system, but also the need to reduce the dependency on grants, which basically we spoke about this workfare programs and all of that. To quite a significant extent, when we looked at the budget, as it was tabled and the allocation of resources, we were quite happy to see that most of these recommendations basically could find resonance with what actually came out. Where we have not been, I wouldn't say we've been disappointed a bit, but it's really around the rehabilitation and addressing of infrastructure backlogs. What I'm aware of at this point in time is that there will be a review of the provincial or infrastructure grant for provinces that sits with the National Treasury to actually address this issue of roads as a key issue in 2011. But for 2010, there was not sufficient movement or visible movement around this area. So we at the Commission, we basically do not look at our recommendations and say we must see them being implemented the following year, as we have. We tend to look at this over a long-term period and are basically looking over the medium-term expenditure period for that particular year for which we table the recommendation. So this is an ongoing kind of a process. With respect to local government capacity, there's quite a number of recommendations that were made. We have seen in the past year or so a number of initiatives, primarily from the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, around trying to relook at the capacity of municipalities to deliver. There's also some concerted effort from the National Treasury side also around this capacity building. But what we think is probably still missing is a visible, coherent joint effort at coordinating these kinds of programs. And we basically hope that going forward, the different departments would be able, through customs base, we hope that that will actually assist in trying to redirect the efforts that are aimed at building the capacity of local governments to actually deliver and also to manage their resources. There are other submissions that we actually make which are outside of the normal legislative ones that we must make. There are other submissions that we make because we must respond, and these tend to be those submissions that are found in a lot of pieces of legislation. Like I said in the beginning, that there's key legislation for the mandate, and then there are other pieces of legislation that will. So these submissions are basically listed in 14, slide number 14. Let me stop here and ask my chief financial officer to talk to the numbers as they relate to the finances of the commission, and then I will ask my colleague Commissioner Ajam to speak to the last couple of slides. We talk to what we consider to be our challenges, not necessarily challenges but also opportunities, because those challenges do present their own opportunities for the commission.
Thank you, sir. For your honorable chair, I think my presentation specifically will be on the financial side of the commission, which is tabled on the annual report from page 83, which is part of our financial statement position and also the financial performance position. I think in terms of the revenue, our total revenue that we normally received from the allocations on the current year that we're reporting, it was sitting at 26.5 million. And then we've got a slight revenue there of 97,000 that comes out of the interest that we received from the bank. Comparatively to the previous year, it was just a 1% increase. And we do understand in terms of the low inflation adjustment that the government is facing around there. And then we also see that there was a movement, an increase on personnel cost, which is our employee cost, on page 84, moving from 15.1 to 17.6 million. And one of the reasons was that, as the chairperson has highlighted, one of the things in terms of looking at the delivery model that we had to look at the current structure that the government is having in terms of its TPSA. We use TPSA in fact as a benchmarking for our employees, and that was the increase basically that we had in that particular year. And then the following one is just the decrease on the depreciation due to obsolete of computer equipment, and following that is you'll see there was also a 36% decrease on professional fees, and due that is in the financial constraints that we had to for some of the project that we do and try to roll over to the other years. And then also operating expenses, we had quite a rigorous exercise within the SSC to make sure that the resources are just channeled to the right. We had to make some savings in some of the areas, but we had to do some cuts in some of the areas given the budget allocation that we have. And then also you'll see also in our balance sheet, our asset base has also decreased by 60% compared to the other year. And then also on the liability side, our liabilities have been reduced by 18%, and then that's due to reduction on financial obligation and also making sure that we keep our timelines in terms of our payments within the 30 days that the government has required. And also you see there have been a decrease on cash flow comparatively to the other year, and due to the baseline allocation. But you'll see when I talked about the MTF allocation, that cash flow is being addressed in the years to come. The next slide just gives you the amount in terms of the revenue that we received. Just a summary of that, 97,000. Just the interest that we received, and the 26.5 is just 26.5 million, the allocation that we have received. And then in terms of the personnel cost, you will see that out of the personnel cost, as a research is divided into two areas. We've got the research and recommendation program, which is the core business of the SFC, where it employs a lot of researchers and so on. And then you've got the support services. You see, most of our personnel costs, they go to research and recommendation program, and then by support services, which involve our corporate services, our finance, and so on. And then we've got the commissioners. Commissioners, as the acting chairperson has highlighted, that in the year that we're reporting, we had two full-time commissioners, our chair and the deputy chair, and then we had other five non-executive commissioners, which is part of the 14% that you see. And then on professional fees, that you see, the amount that you see on the professional fees there is broken down into the major amount that is being consumed by the audit fees. Audit fees consume almost over just over 5% of our total budget. Currently, the 1.3 million out of professional fees, they go to audit fees. And then we've got the commission, the research, which is some of the technical advisors that are being used on the research unit. We consume 36% of that amount. And then other consulting services that you normally use, your IT, they are around the 80%. And then when you break down the operating expenses, you see the major expenses that you normally have, one is the traveling. Most of our researchers, they do some traveling when they do the kind of work that they do in terms of their research. And then also we've got office premises that we have to pay for ourselves. And then we also conduct workshops and seminars for the kind of information that they normally collect through the research and making sure that it's being inserted properly through our system. And then also we've got publications that we normally produce on an annual basis, that is our annual submission that we normally table to Parliament, and also the annual report. Those are some of the costs that we normally incur. And then we've got our IT equipment, which is also one of the major cost drivers within the organization. And then after that, we've got the other operating costs that involve the running and administration side of the office. And then the last slide just show the allocation, the growth in terms of the allocation and the budget that we have. You could see, as indicated earlier, our budget has previously not been growing, but going forward through the consultation that we have with National Treasury, trying to highlight some of the budget pressures that we have, we did get an injection in this current financial year, increase moving from 26.5 to 31.3 to be able to deal with some of the financial pressure that we have. And then you'll see going forward it's increasing from moving from 31, 33 and 34 million. In terms of the overall finance position, this is a status that we have. And I must also highlight that we have been having very, major internal controls to deal with some of the challenges, especially with the speed budget, and making sure that we still deliver the kind of service that we're expected to deliver within the limited budget constraints that we have. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. As my colleague indicated, I'll be speaking to the opportunities and challenges that the SFC faces. As the Chair rightly commented on, we are an institution in transition, but I must say that we fully support our acting chair. We are, the rest of us are non-executive commissioners, but non-executive does not mean not involved. We are fully involved in trying to make sure that we use this transition not only to maintain what we've been doing, but to also extend it. The acting commissioner would have also pointed out that the IGFR system is also undergoing major rethinks. The local government equitable share, my colleague mentioned, the provincial government equitable share, somewhere in the wings, started in 2007 with government's review of provinces and local government, which hasn't been concluded. So there's a lot of serious thinking about where we are in the intergovernmental system, what have we learned, and how can we make things work better. And that means that it's going to be an opportunity for the SSC to really engage at that level. Moving on to some of the specific opportunities and challenges, I think that we are a research-based organization because we try and deliver evidence-based policy. And as you know, skills in South Africa are scarce. The type of skills that we are trying to put together are probably some of the most scarce available. We've been very lucky to so far have assembled an excellent research team, core research team, and we want to do everything in our power to make sure that we can retain them. Unfortunately, that also includes making sure the conditions of service are competitive, both in the private sector and with other public sector counterparts. The next area is that we have had primary research resources in which to manage our research portfolio. Now, as you know, we present our recommendations about a year ahead of the actual budget process, which means that we need to start choosing our research projects in our research portfolio even a year before that. So a lot of our work is long-term research. But from our stakeholders, like Parliament, you often find that in the short term, new issues come around. And what we do try and do is also make sure that we have rapid response. It's not part of the long-term research project, but it is important for our mandate and it is relevant for our stakeholders. And so we want to be able to engage at a rapid response level as well. My colleague mentioned that we've substantially increased our budget analysis capability at national, provincial, and local government level. But we can't do as much as we would like to do because we face the resource constraints. The other thing is that, as my colleague mentioned, the Money Bills Amendment and Related Matters Act provides an amazing opportunity for the SSC's research to actually be used. A concern for an organization like us is that we can produce excellent research, we can generate insights, but if nobody takes action on that, then that effort would have been wasted. So it's an amazing opportunity for us, but it also places increased demands on us to be able to produce the evidence-based research that we can underpin our policy as well. The Commission is a very small organization, but unfortunately, as you know, many of the governance obligations across the public sector apply to all institutions, whether large or small. The Chief Financial Officer pointed out how much we spend, for example, on audit fees. In the private sector, there's been a move to try and make sure that small businesses don't have to go through the exact same level of audit procedures as big businesses. Unfortunately, this isn't yet the case in the public sector. So you see, find that the Commission has to deal with some of those pressures within its current budget. While the Commission has received an increase in baseline, this has been transient since the bulk of the resources went towards addressing tough problems. I think what we're saying is that we will try and optimize within our current baselines, but we also see where the system is evolving, and we feel that should the demand for the type of policy advice and insight and research increase significantly, as we anticipate it will, we might really have problems reconciling our limited budget with meeting those needs. Having said that, what we are trying to do as a Commission is to review our operating model in a way to try and see how we can optimize and generate as much resources as possible so that we can direct it towards our core business, which is research and policy advice. And we have looked at imposition of austerity measures to try and make sure that we can direct funds to where those are needed and where they can meet the needs of our stakeholders. We have tried to extend our stakeholder interaction not just to Parliament in Cape Town and in Gauteng, but also to try and reach more of the provinces. Increasingly, municipalities are becoming important players, including cities. worthwhile liaising with them. Budget constraints, however, make it very difficult for us to be able to do that. It's important for us because our work can be very technical. So in a presentation, you can actually deal with one-on-one issues, and you can make sure that you also listen to your stakeholders and understand them. But unfortunately, we can't do as much of that sort of consultation as we would like to do. My colleague also mentioned that we had in 2004 already said that we need to rethink our research strategy. Much of the initial research on IGR was looking at formulas and allocation mechanisms. But the real issue is that money actually making a difference? Are we making a developmental impact? And we said that the research should not only look at the technical IGFR instruments and formulas, but also see, does the IGFR system actually facilitate that development impact, or is it actually, in some cases, maybe acting as an impediment to that development impact? So we were very pleased to see that government has also moved towards the outcomes-based approach. And even though we have been following the documents as a commission, we will need to sit down and try and understand what does the outcomes-based approach mean for the IGFR system. Because if you look at all of the outcomes, they all cut across all three spheres of government. They all cut across sectors. But the way the IGFR system is currently set up is very much structured along sectoral lines. So you have a mimic and you have intergovernmental process for health, for education. But if you look at something like rural development, it actually cuts across all of those areas. And Parliament also has to exercise oversight across all of those areas because it's not each individual sector that's important in itself, it's whether that impact actually gets made. So conceptually, it will take quite a lot of thinking for us to see how we fit in and our research can help support that. We have raised a couple of corporate governance issues, mainly arising from the fact that the SFC Act preceded the Public Finance Management Act and many other pieces of legislation. And we need to make sure that there is alignment so that there aren't any gaps or issues that we need to deal with. And that's the process that my colleague, the Acting Commissioner, has already started to look at. So that is a quick summary of some of the opportunities and challenges that await us at the SFC, and I'm going to hand over to Bruno to take us further.
Thank you, Tanya. Honourable Chair, I think this is where our presentation stops, and I hand back over to you.
Thank you, Bongani and your team. I think at this stage I would suggest that we take a 10-minute comfort break and come back to engage. Don't want to overstretch your listening capacity, honorable members. We'll gradually be re-engineered and re-infused into work. 10-minute comfort break. And honorable Bloom, you are an honorable member with a bench assigned to you wherever you go. When you come back, just occupy your bench here.
We will reintegrate you. Okay.
I'm going to be Honourable members, we thank you to the acting chairperson of the SFC, Mr. Pumala, for his presentation and the rest of his team. There's now time for questions. Just from my side, looking at the composition of the SFC in page 17 and 18, the commissioners time that expired on the 30th of June 2009. It's one, two, three of them.
Nella?
And then you said one person had to be replaced, the national nominee. But didn't accept. The matter has been communicated to the president and the relevant minister. Could you give some more clarity on that? Because this is the 30th of June 2009. It's quite a while ago. How did that affect your working of the SSC? Honourable members? Who's first? And then please note, Mr. Kuranov, your number one. That order, you may start. Please introduce yourself to the Mr. Kumalo and his team, and then you can put your question.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I am Nick Kornoff. Can I just ask, you know, I've seen that traveling was quite a high amount in terms of the budget of the FEC. I just want to know why. Why is it such an important expense with regard to the work of the FFC? And then if you also look at your annual report on page 112, you can see that you have expenses on an American Express card of close to 800,000 rand. I just want a little bit more of a breakdown of that. And then also on La Riva Lodge, 135,000. Was it for a conference? What was the need for that? And then on page 26, your strategic objectives, you say that you will do a performance of public hospitals and an evaluation of the national health insurance policy proposal. But that's on hold now. According to this report, I just want to know, will you now resume with that?
Thank you, Quartet. Luyenge. My question is with regard first to the mandate of the commission, which is more research based. Now, what I wanted to check is to whether the recommendations submitted by the commission to government are actually adhered to or considered by government. Is there any binding mechanism on the part of government to ensure that the recommendations of the commission are considered? Then secondly, on the issue of the workings of the spheres of government in relation to public infrastructure and social assistance, it's very clear, Chair, that the spirit of cooperative so-called IDPs, PGDPs, and NSDPs. But what is it that the research project of the Commission say about that? Because we are now 16 years in our democracy, and the cooperative mechanism of government does not assist in terms of the infrastructure development. The current infrastructure now, that was actually began in the beginning of the new dawn of democracy, it's decaying now. So there is a continuous infrastructural decay that exists. The decay is as a result of the non-maintenance of the infrastructure that existed in the past, and the non-maintenance of the infrastructure that has actually been developed by the current government. So, what suggestion does the commission consider to ensure that what the Department of Finance or Treasury is saying around these issues, to say we are going to all these things that are actually coming, that actually came out of Treasury, they are all in future. There's nothing that says, starting from the past financial year, this is what we have done, and the infrastructure is in this state of affairs, and in fact, without any exaggeration, there is nothing in terms of the infrastructure management. If monies are returned back to Treasury, municipalities, the MIG is not spent, roads are not built, be it provincial or access roads.
Thank you, coaches. Amadlamini. Like what the previous honorable member has indicated, that the core function of the FSC is research based. Now I'm sitting here and I'm wondering how effective that function is executed. Because the government put down the 5 priority areas of focus for this term, 5-year term. And it also went further and gave 12 outcomes based on those 5 priorities. Now, the FSC, if its function is research-based, isn't it supposed to assist this committee by saying those 5 priorities that were put by the government, this is how we see its implementation, this is how we see its performance and the tool of evaluation. Mm-hmm. Now, it worries when you look at the summary of the report that within the report, there are 3 of those 5 key priority areas of government that were put on hold. It's health, inclusive education, it's local government. And all of these projects are put on hold. But you don't see within the report where the commission's achievements indicating to the committee and say, look, we are aware that these projects are on hold, but is the committee aware that if these projects are on hold, these are the reasons why they are on hold? This is are going to be the implication or the consequences towards the hold. We fail to get that. It's even worse, Comrade Chair, that the FSC is telling us that the provincial equitable share still fail to give us an efficient and effective model. But if I remember last year, we said to the FSC, without working with the statistician to get accurate data, they will not come out with an accurate information as far as the equitable share is concerned. Now, it worries because one of the key functions of this FSC is to ensure that there's an inclusive education system. How are you going to achieve that? Was this due to the shortages or the personnel within your department that you did not recruit, or the vacancies that they were not there? What is happening? Can we get the clarity on those? Because really and truly, the numbers that we think that it doesn't tell. There is no alignment of your research with the government priorities and the 12 outcomes. Thank you, Chair.
The issue of constraints is coming on since the report of 08, 2008 and 2009 on the constraints. Dr. George, I've noted you.
Thank you, Chair. On page number 2 of the slides, it was mentioned about a member who was appointed but never took up the position. Did any payments get made to this person from the Commission for anticipated work that they were going to do? Then on the annual report on page number 11 and 12, it makes reference to the Act, the amendment, the Money Bills and Related Matters Act, and it refers to the fact that there would be some kind of pressure on FSC as a result of that. While you were going through the presentation, it was very clear to me that there's a lot of research. You mentioned it yourself, and that question also came up as, is it used effectively? It seems to me that there's a lot of work that the Parliamentary Budget Office that we haven't set up yet is going to be doing also in terms of research. When you say it's going to, this new act is going to put strain on the Commission, what do you mean by that? And in terms of resourcing, you're saying that it would be some kind of pressure. What does that actually mean? And then on page number 26, there was reference to the National Health Insurance, where there was some kind of research that was being done, but it was put on hold, it says here, on hold pending declaration of government approach and position on the NHI. Do you now have the government's position on the NHI, and if so, are you doing any work on it? And then finally, on page number 36, there's reference to the social assistance grants. Now, you state the obvious that it puts pressure on the FISC, which is pretty obvious. However, the social grant system in South Africa is not very generous. The reason why it is so expensive is because there's so many people in the net. That's what makes it expensive. And you rightly say here that there must be some kind of intervention to reduce the number of people dependent on the social security net. But what you don't say in here, you talk about the Extended Public Works Program. You're not talking about the environment that would facilitate job creation in South Africa. You're talking about government providing jobs through the Extended Public Works Program. It can't do that. It doesn't have the capacity to do that. What about things that need to happen in the economy to make it more possible for more jobs to be created? Have you not given that any thought? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I am on page 58.
Oh, thank you very much. The Finance Committee. I would like to find out on page 58, in fact it's page 59, about the adequate capacity which is critical for a concern, which is a critical concern for municipalities, as correctly outlined, and indeed true as it is I just want to find out if there are any moves to create a better way of handling this. As I have noticed that this has been repeatedly said over many, many years now. The second question is about the skills inventory. I just need to find out from the FSC, who is the custodian of the skills inventory in government? Because many a times we think that it is a labor, sometimes we think that it's a... If you can just tell us, what is your role as far as that? What are we short of in terms of skills in South Africa? The last question is about the NDG goals, whether you are part of the NDG, and we have now received a report. I suppose that report must still be discussed, but what is your take on the Millennium Development Goals? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. My name is Enoch Mteto. I just want to get a clarity, Chair, on the professional fees. Looking at the slides that is being presented there, one will say that your audit fee is looked to be more higher than your core function, which is commissioning of the research. Can we get a comment on that one?
Maybe it will also be a follow-up for what numbers have just I've realized this that the institution, the core business of the institution is research indeed. But now I see here you say you have the research program and research unit. But you go on to say that there is a commissioned research that you must pay, that is technical, you say there is technical assistance, something like that. Does that mean that you do not have full-time researchers, or there is no capacity, no resources? And I see here on our analysis report that you have a 10% vacancy rate. Does that include researchers? Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Maybe starting with
human resource aspects. I want to ask the question if there's a clear existence of a retention strategy and the implementation thereof, and also what are the constraints, if there are constraints in terms of realizing such, because it has been cited that the exodus of the necessary skills is one of the challenges that are, HR challenges that are facing the Commission. And on page, I think it's page 95. On expenditure that is awaiting condonation, the issue of late payment of tax as well as long services bonus. Apparently, for the long services bonus, there was a need that. The Commission must obtain approval from the President's office prior to paying a long-term service bonus to a commissioner. Maybe that's the reason why there is a need for condonation. So could you please get some more information on the two aspects, the payment of tax as well as long service bonus. But lastly, is the loan that was obviously given to Commissioner Bukhari. Was this loan ultimately paid? And I'm very much interested to know what are the conditions of such provision. Mm. Thank you.
more questions, Mr. Kumalo, you and your team can respond.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members. I am going to answer some of the questions, and then I'll share some of them with my colleagues here. Let me start with the first set of questions, and that is from you, Honorable De Beer. The question about the vacancies, I think it relates to the vacancies and the impact on the work of the Commission. I think in terms of the work of the Commission, the way in which the Commission operates is such that the part-time commissioners, the non-full-time commissioners, interact directly with the work of the Commission only in the meetings that are scheduled, the scheduled meetings of the Commission. That's where they interact directly. Indirectly, there are subcommittees of the Commission that must also look at certain aspects of the way the Commission works. So the research aspect, which informs the recommendations that the Commission actually has to make, has a research committee. And so in terms of the key mandate of the Commission, there is really no impact between 2009 in the current period, because the research process basically works. In terms of the Commission's meetings and quorum, which is what we require to pass any of these recommendations, again, there is no impact of that missing, let me say, of the missing two commissioners. So we still have seven, so we were still quorum, so we could actually operate normally. I don't know whether that actually answered the question. So the impact is very minimal. It's insignificant. The question around, Honorable Cornell's questions, why is traveling such a high percentage of your expenses? Traveling is a high percentage of our expenses because most of the stakeholder interaction takes place outside of Gauteng. So we do most of our work with legislatures. So the parliament in Cape Town is also in the different provinces and sometimes municipalities when there's a need to do that. Now, that's like commission business for commissioners themselves. That's the one aspect of it. Then the other aspect is for the research program, which is housed in the secretariat of the commission. There's also a lot of traveling involved in terms of interacting with the stakeholders and basically picking up on information, doing, for example, provincial visits to look at constraints in different provinces and to bring that information together. So the work basically, the nature of the work is not desktop-based. It's people have to do these kinds of things for as a matter of course. Now, I will skip the issues around the financial. Also, the CFO will come back and speak to the MSU note that the American Express got and the Mariba launch. Now, on the NHI and hospital performance, I think in terms of our report, what we're basically saying there is we put certain projects on hold. Now, and I think this comes up again. I hope my response here will also capture the concerns from the other members that raised this. But I will give some more details when I come back to Honorable Matlamini's questions around this matter. Now, on the NHI, basically, because our 2000, we Commissioner Abraham indicated that we start our research process. It's basically 2 years in advance of the budget that we're actually going to be tabling the recommendations for. So going for 2009, for the 2009 cycle to make recommendations for 2010 would basically mean that our decisions on projects to do would have had to be made in March 2008. So basically, you've got about 18 months or so to start the cycle and decide. Now the discussion around the NHI at that point was still a discussion. The hospital performance part of that work, there had been a set of recommendations tabled for the 2009 Division of Revenue on hospital performance and hospital management. So we actually have done some work on that and tabled some recommendations around it and gotten a response from government. Having not seen any movement around those recommendations, even though they had been accepted, we then have to balance this thing. We trade off our financial position at that point. If you look at the slide that gives you the revenue, we were at a very delicate point. We were emerging from a period of a deficit. What then happened is that in terms of the allocation that had been given, it was actually less, far much less than we had requested, and so it was not a very good year. So we had to make some trade-offs on priority, and we did not prioritize that project, specifically the NHI aspect of it. Question from Honorable Luyenge. It's on the mandate, basically, and whether the recommendations that we make are adhered to. Are they binding recommendations and so on? I think here, I must say that the recommendations that the Commission makes are not binding. To the extent that the Commission must know why a recommendation has not been accepted, the Minister is compelled by law to attach his response to the Division of Revenue Bill when he tables that Division of Revenue Bill and explain why certain recommendations that were made have not been accepted and also why certain recommendations have been accepted. So in terms of how they then get treated after that, we basically do not think that the Commission has a role in terms of the law to actually ensure that those that have been accepted are actually implemented. We are of the view that because the Commission makes its recommendations primarily to Parliament as well, Parliament might probably be the right institution or organ to actually then follow up on the implementation of those recommendations that have been accepted. That is the position there. With respect to the issue of public infrastructure, social assistance, and all of that in the spirit of cooperative governance, well, the question here basically is, what does the research of the Commission say about these kinds of issues, and how can the Commission assist in this? I think it is a very clear position that we find ourselves faced with, that there is indeed a disjuncture in the way in which things are done amongst sectors and also amongst spheres of government. Now, that coordination aspect is actually very weak. I'm not going to say that it's not there. I will say that it is very weak. We have myself, for example, I have accompanied some of the parliamentary committees on their oversight visits just to get a picture of what is actually happening. Simply in the capacity building that municipalities that are always slated for lack of delivery, provinces and national government have a responsibility for assisting those municipalities that require capacity building. But when you look at the kind of programs and you listen to those departments that actually are involved in those, you find that those programs that are actually put in place are not programs that come from a province or that come from a national government. They are programs that come from single departments, and there's no way you can actually put together something that says coordinated in any way. So municipalities basically will have to do this from this department, and another department comes with its own kind of advice, whether it's from the national level, because it also happens that your line department at the provincial level might have different views from the line department at the national level. If something happened in the Northwest, which was quite it's not funny, but it's quite an eye-opener of how lack of this interaction can basically result in municipalities being confused and probably not taking any action in certain areas as a result of the confusion that's coming from the broad institutions that seek to assist in capacity building. So it might be necessary, I think the Commission has raised these issues in the past, it might be necessary for us to actually revisit those recommendations and look at what government said about them and say then we must actually then ask what is it that they put in place to ensure that this is actually happening. Now, that is the part that I'm saying as a commission, we probably don't have that power to do that to any government department. Let me then come to Honorable Majlamini's question. Basically, it's about the effectiveness of the FFC in executing its mandate. I think that is the broad question that I pick up from you, and whether or not what the FFC is doing is actually relevant to what wants to see happening. How does the FFC assist this committee in as far as the 12 key outcome areas are concerned? I will ask also my fellow commissioner here to add onto my responses here. And you further ask the question, why were the projects that seemed to be part of the, not even the 12, but the 5 key priorities, why were they canned? Why were they put on hold? And what are the consequences of that? Now, I think picking this up from what I said about the recent cycle of the commission, and when these priorities are actually identified, we work very closely with the budget process, and so the priorities for any particular year, for any particular MTEF, are what actually drive us in prioritizing our own work for that MTEF period. So, given the financial constraints that we had in 2007 and 2008, and the work that we already have been doing around health and around education, at that particular point in time, we were dealing with basic education, dealing with issues around the school nutrition program, learner transport, and all of that. Those were actually areas that had been put on top. Now, we must also remember that as a commission, the work that we do involves, in one way or another, ensuring that resources actually go to those priority areas that have been identified on the basis of the sphere that is actually responsible for that priority. Now, at that point in time, we were not even talking about this kind of a delivery model that government post 2009, then post 2009 election then adopted. So we were still talking at a very sectoral level. Now, with respect to inclusive education, it's come a very long way. The commission did a lot of work on inclusive education when it was still called special education or something like that. We did quite a lot of work around about 2001, 2002, 2003. And so we combined that work with any childhood development. We combined it with further education and training. We combined it with adult basic education and training. And the key issues that we were raising were that government actually needs to set the norms and standards around components of basic education or public ordinary school education. Those are the key or on FET. So what was very clear was that without those norms and standards being established, it was going to be very difficult to determine the sufficiency of resources going to the provinces to be able to do or carry out those kinds of functions. And what happened is that something happened with ECD, so the norms and standards were developed. Something happened with FET, the norms and standards were developed. The adult basic education and training, I think work is still going. Inclusive education, again, work is still going. Now, in terms of our work, in the absence of those norms and standards that have actually been set, it is going to be very difficult to actually start new work around the financing of such programs if we don't actually have that. Now, in terms of the prioritization process, basically, so that's how we then say resources are not available. There's still work that is going on around this, so there's still uncertainty around how it's actually going to be delivered. So the funding tied to it would still have to be coming through. I don't know whether it comes through some conditional grant or however they are dealing with it at this particular point in time. It's difficult because of that. So we basically deprioritize in that. It's not to say that when we deprioritize for any 1 year, we are actually saying this is not important. We are actually saying on the basis of what the priorities for the MTEF are, these are the issues that we must consider. Now, what I can say at this point in time is that if you come back to the work that the Commission is doing this year on the basis of the outcomes that have been defined and the outcomes that have been prioritized amongst those, you will find that the projects that the Commission is currently working on, and we will be meeting to review what has been done so far in the next month in November, I think it's November 17, if I'm not mistaken, capture all of these issues that we had actually deprioritized, so including the NHI, notwithstanding the fact that the question that was asked, I think, by Honorable Dr. George, whether we now have government's position on this. Notwithstanding that, we actually don't have government's position on it. We have an understanding that at least at a certain level, this is an issue that has been discussed. We have discussed that in Budget Council, so we've seen discussions around it, around what must be done first before we can actually move to the NHI. So there is some direction that we basically get by virtue of being part and parcel of the budget process, so we can actually get that. So it is part of the work that is in the current work cycle of the Commission. The broader issue, though, that I want to raise here is that in most of these institutions that actually define what the priorities are going to be and all of that, we as a Commission find ourselves sitting outside. So we have to be following from our own, what do we call it, sentence? I don't know. But we find ourselves sitting outside of all of these discussions. And so we pick them up. So sometimes we are able to pick them up quite quickly. Sometimes we are not able to pick them up quite quickly. We pick them up because they are on the table. Some people are already discussing it. This is the way it's going to happen, and we are going to have a special commission to do 1, 2, 3 things. We are not aware when those kinds of things happen. Now, we sometimes say to ourselves, in any case, at some point in time, once the reports have been prepared,
spirit of the point, which is set what other departments or what the responsible departments have to do in this whole process to ensure that the commission is part of the process. Some of them basically skip I don't want to say they ignore, but they probably are ignorant of what is required when you have to do certain of those things that require, that might have financial and fiscal implications for different spheres of government in terms of the FFC Act. So I can quote examples of legislation and situations where things have been taken from step one and passed and the FFC has not been consulted. And we only pick it up because now there are problems in the system. So some issues around unfunded mandates basically arise because of those kinds of processes where functions just get shifted and the commission's advice is not sought. We can follow that task if there's a need. Can I ask at this point Tanya to speak a bit to this issue on the money bills amendment procedures from that Honorable George asked. Then I'll come back.
I think that the Honorable asked two main elements of the question. One was related to the Parliamentary Budget Office and whether the FFC fit in with that. And then the second one is what are some of the impacts of the money bills amendment to that and related matter act on FFC operations. I think that we have to realize that the Parliamentary Budget Office always be doing different work from the FFC. The FFC's job is to look at developments in the economy and in the intergovernmental system through the lens of the intergovernmental system. So there are certain areas that we will not venture into because it's not within our mandate, right? Also, once the allocations are made and individual appropriations get made at a provincial level or municipal level, that level of analysis, which will be critical to the Parliamentary Budget Office, is not something that we would do. So the Parliamentary Budget Office would say, you know, if you move from X to Y, what will be the impact on the X department? What will be the impact on the Y department? That is a different level of analysis. It's specialized in itself. FFC will never be able to do it. That said, let's look specifically at what the impact of the money bond process will be. I think that what's important is that you actually have a three-stage budget process now. You have a process that looks at economic outlook and then the overall fiscal framework, how much total you have to spend. Then you have the normal division of revenue, which we were involved in. And then you look at more detailed allocations, conditional grants, that sort of thing. So the shift of our work now is not only looking at the division of revenue kind of allocation things, but also looking at it in the context of the broader fiscal framework issues. What your Parliament is already aware of is that the time frames for these responses are very short. So we can do a lot of work in preparation, but it's a very short time that we actually get the figures. And then we actually need to withdraw all of our costs so that they can work on this, which means that obviously our longer term research has to be a bit on hold. Also, bear in mind that the FFC makes recommendations across a number of sectors. We've spoken about infrastructure, we've spoken about transport, we've spoken about health, we've spoken about education. Each of those portfolio committees will have to do a budget review and recommendations report. And as part of that, they will probably require us to try and understand how our recommendations engage with that function. So I think that will require from us quite a lot of liaison with committees where they express the need for us to do so. I think that the issue of data availability is crucial. We're obviously concerned that the next census is 2011. We only get the results 2 years later. But having said that, government is making strides in improving data information. We have more data on municipalities than we've ever had it before. As that data improves, so it becomes the responsibility for us to use that data and analyze that data. So I think that that's another area. I think that Bonani has said that because we start our cycle so early, we have to guess what the priorities are going to be. And some priorities are always going to be priorities. I think honorable members mentioned health, education. But what about priorities that are in the indigies but that might not be receiving adequate policy attention? For example, the indigies talk about financial sustainability and climate change. Right? Now, we have to say, what is the link between the intergovernmental system and climate change and environmental sustainability? Our counterparts, like commissions in India, the Indian Finance Commission, have considered it in their recommendations. Now, to do that, we need to take financial expertise, but we also need to put it together with environment and climate change expertise. I don't know anything about climate change, but if you explain to me what the policies are, I can tell you what the intergovernmental impact is. So that means that we are going to have to be experts in those fields, and that's why some of our research has got to be outsourced. The other issue is, for example, the knowledge economy, science and technology. We need to make sure that there's not only equitable access of people who were previously marginalized from basic services, that also need to be drawn into the knowledge economy. It's the MDG, but do we have discussions on that in policy circles? We are not certain now what the implications for the IGR system are, right? And this is the type of research that we are actually looking at, because we are hoping to be able to engage, for example, with the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology to say, look, as far as the intergovernmental system is concerned, this is where it links with the FSC. In terms of higher education and building human resources to support a knowledge economy, how does this link to the intergovernmental system? So I think it's really important to realize that we need to align with government, but we also need to point out areas long-term, where government might not be thinking as rigorously as it's thinking in other areas like health, like education. And then finally, I think that one of the questions that was posed to us was saying, look, you say that your social grants system needs to look at reducing dependency. So you only can reduce dependency if you create sustainable livelihoods. So how do you do that? The minute you ask that question, you are stepping beyond the narrow confines of the IGR system, and you need to then understand how the IGR system links with the broader economy. For us to focus not only on the basic services progressive realization issues, but also on current growth and future growth issues, which is something that we've also tabled in our current research cycle, it does require quite a lot of investment in resources, because the minute you talk about the economy, you can't have a shopping list of disparate recommendations. You have to say, taken collectively, do they make sense? And I think that those are some of the challenges that come out of the Moneyball Amendments Act for us.
Okay. Thank you, Tanya. Let me then go to the questions from Honorable Balindlela. She has raised questions around capacity for local government and what I think you also talk about skills inventory and who is responsible for skills inventory. I must say that the issues around skills inventory, I would not know who is actually responsible for skills inventory. I think there's quite a number of departments that have something to do with skills in government. There are also CETAs that also have something to do, structures that have something to do with skills in government. So I think that is the answer that I can give to that. In terms of the capacity for local government, capacity building in local government, I think it's important to say that from the Commission's perspective and from the recommendations that we made and the information that we had, the assessment that we made around capacity building in municipalities basically presents a very dire picture. It does present one with questions of the effectiveness of those programs that we have actually embarked on in the past, and whether or not we have been able to evaluate what those programs, because there have been quite a number of capacity building programs for municipalities.
whether or not those actually generated any is not very evident. Any built any capacity is not very evident if you go to most of the municipalities, especially in the rural areas. It's just not evident that a building program that has been aimed at building capacity in these municipalities. So the story around capacity building is very disappointing, but we can see that there are still quite a number of efforts that are in place. Your Save the Money project, your local government turnaround strategy, which is the most recent program. We also have other programs that the National Treasury is running from a financial management side. Unfortunately, the funds that are allocated for capacity building that sit with the National Treasury and also with the Cooperative Governance Department are also not being taken up. And that creates a problem from the side of a resource allocation point of view. Why must you be putting money that is not actually being utilized? So obviously, what this tells us is that there is still a lot of concerted effort and more coordination that is required around capacity building for municipalities. I must say that for us as a commission, it came as a surprise when we basically picked up on the local government turnaround strategy, because we are one of those institutions that was not consulted when this was actually adopted. So it's one of those things that we must then evaluate as and when it is actually being implemented, and to do that is not always an easy job. But we share the view that capacity building is a very important part of what government needs to do going forward. With respect to the Millennium Development Goals and the report that has just recently been tabled, we actually have seen the report. We have a project basically in the commission that is currently running on MDGs, and if one looks at our recommendations for the 2011 Division of Revenue, you find that we make reference to the likely impact of the world economic crisis that we are emerging from on the achievement and attainment of some of those Millennium Development Goals. And in this particular research cycle, we are actually going into details on some specific Millennium Development Goals to look at what is actually happening there. So at the Commission, I wouldn't say that we have a view at this point in time on the report that has recently been tabled, but we will basically be discussing that as part of our current work in the research cycle, which our discussion on it is basically in November this coming month. And then to Honorable Teto, I think you asked about the audit fees. I will leave those to my CFO. The issue around commissioned research versus our having a fully fledged research and recommendations program. That one basically is that we commission research on very specific, specialized topics. I think what we said up front is that we have a difficulty in getting the necessary expertise for which our work dictates that we should have. But we don't have all the skills in-house. For example, some of the issues require specialist health economists, and you might not be able to get a specialist health economist who also has an understanding of what intergovernmental fiscal relations is. So we can pay a researcher internally who has an understanding of our IGFR system with a specialized health economist, for example, to work on a specific project. And those skills don't actually come very cheap. We actually have to source them sometimes even from abroad. So it's not always very cheap, very easy to do some of those things without that technical assistance. What you would notice is that you see that over a period period of time, the commission has reduced substantially the reliance on this type of research, which we call the commissioned research, because what we've been trying to do, we've been trying to build our own capacity, which is partly the reason why we migrated to this DPSA remuneration structure as a benchmark, because we were losing every 3 years, we would lose a researcher that joined. So the researcher's turnaround time would be 3 years at the commission, and then they move. So he's a researcher here, he moves to government and becomes the chief director or a director. So we were losing people to government. We didn't think that that was a very bad thing, because they're still working in the same system. But for the commission as an institution, that was quite a bad thing. And so we tried to try and retain them. Now, obviously, a retention strategy would have to go beyond just the cash or whatever remuneration. You've got to build in something that interests researchers in doing their work. And one of the things that we did was to facilitate a process for researchers to be able to publish their work outside of what the commission takes from them. So that is an issue around research and how we are trying to retain. We are all the time looking at rewarding these researchers with allowing them the opportunities to interact with the researchers, established researchers, at a higher level, because most of the researchers that we have are basically very young researchers. I think some of the members have seen some of our researchers that we have brought here are basically young. We've got only maybe about two or so that are at a PhD level, and we've got maybe about four or so that are at a master's level. The rest of them are honors graduates and still working on their master's degree. So at some point when we had money, we would actually provide assistance for them to get master's degrees. But what then happened was that once they have gotten that master's degree, they then move away, and that became self-defeating. So what we're trying to do now is to refocus our attention at retaining those that we actually have and ensuring that we build on their skills. The expenditure awaiting condonation, I also leave to my CFO and the Commission Secretary to respond to. Let me just check. I think Honorable Magdalene, there's one that I skipped where you spoke about the equitable share formula and the statistics. I think that's probably not the same time that I've had to respond to you on that one. But let me respond again. The issue here around the equitable share formula, and I must say again that for the Commission, the work that we did in 2007 around the equitable share formula, we found that about 96-97% of the allocation in the equitable share formula actually goes out in the form of, is driven by population in one way or another. So the base population that you're using is your 2001 census. Yeah. Now the question that one must ask is that a correct thing to actually allocate resources on the basis of such outdated data? So one of the recommendations that we made was that let's revisit the measures that we put in some of those components so that we dilute the impact of population. Because it's now almost accepted that we are not going to have census on a five-yearly basis. It's actually probably going to be more than 5 years. It's going to be 10 years. I don't know whether it's going to be 11 years or it's going to be. So that actually means in between
revenues to be distributed according to numbers that are disputed to that kind of a level. So I want to agree with you that there is a problem with the data. Now, the one way of addressing it is basically to dilute the strength of population as a key driver in the allocation formula, both for the local government with the share formula, and also for the provincial equitable share formula. What I have seen so far in terms of the review that is taking place is that there is some movement around looking at utilization rates, for example, for public health facilities in the healthcare component. There is also a dilution of the population aspect in the education component, because the Department of Education's systems have improved in terms of how they actually capture school enrollment numbers, and the credibility of those numbers has actually improved quite substantially. So that also tends to dilute the census side of the, but it's still 50% of the education component allocation is based on what you call your school going age population. So you still have that 2001 influence in that formula, although you've now increased the weight, the sub weight for the enrollment. So what one could do could be to say, if as we trust the enrollment numbers more and more, we can increase the weighting attached to the enrollment as opposed to the. So these are things that are actually on the, these are issues that are on the table. The final formula, basically, I suppose, will be tabled with the Division of Revenue Bill in February. But there is still discussion at a technical level on which direction to take. And as a commission, we are still to make our own recommendation on the final decision that government will have taken around this issue. But certainly, that matter that you raised, Honourable Member, we have raised in the recommendations that were submitted to inform government in the review that they are actually undertaking. Let me stop here and ask the CFO and the Secretary to respond to the other questions.
Thank you. Let me start with the question I think was raised by Honourable Goranov in terms of what goes on to the travelling costs that are so high. I think part of that question you have answered in terms of our research and the commissioner that normally travels to our federal stakeholders, which is one of the core functional areas that we normally do. And then also in terms of the what goes on in that MFL Express card and MFL Express travel that was highlighted on page 112. I think what normally happens in terms of all these travel arrangements that you normally do, it involves the accommodation when they go in those places, the traveling, your car hire, if they fly in those places, your air tickets and so on. But what you normally do, we don't have an in-house, it's an American Express card, is a division that normally pays over to the traveling agent that you use, the American travel. That's why you see that difference that is highlighted there on page 112. And then coming to the question that was asked around the difference between the audit fees, clearly between audit fees and the commission research, why audit fees are so high. In terms of the audit fees, we don't have so much control in them because there are standard rates that are being set by the auditor general in terms of setting up those fees. And we try to stick within those standard set rates. But what we have also tried to do is to take it at this issue further with national pressure in terms of looking how can they accommodate this kind of pressure that are obligatory in nature. And then coming to the question that was raised by Honourable Member around the long service bonus and the loan for Mr. B. Kumar, I think one of the issues that was highlighted earlier, I think, by the Commissioner was that the FSC Act, which preceded some of the acts and processes of the government, like the PFMA and the Public Service Act, which the
the commissioners are employed according to those. There are certain benefits that they are entitled to, that they have to have. But what is important around that? Because the FSCF states that since they are appointed by the president, all those benefits should be signed off by the president. You might find out the processes take longer, unlike any other government department. And when that increases, inflationary increases, we don't automatically put, you should wait for those letters. They normally take longer than the expected. And then also part of the retention strategy that was explained by the commissioners earlier on, what we have in terms of the professors, before Commissioner Kumalo became the commissioner, he was one of the senior researchers within the FSC. And then we had a policy within the FSC that if you finish a 10-year period being a senior researcher and being the staff of the FSC, there are certain rewards based on a certain percentage on your salary. That's what happened. But because of what the timing part when he was appointed as a chairperson and also when he was a senior researcher, and then we had to disclose. That's why if you see to look at the both amounts, it's the same amount that was recognized as a loan and also as a long term. It's recognized as a loan because until that is cleared out, and then it will be regarded as a loan. That's why we disclose in that way in the financial statement.
But it's more of a recommendation, because the main reason for this process or this exercise that we're doing today is to ensure that the recommendations are efficient recommendations for the minister to be able to table an effective budget next year. Since you have got an outstanding norms and standards, but some they've actually submitted, is it possible that you fast track the norms and standards for those that are still outstanding, so that at the end of the day, the funding gets available? When the minister table, then we see this, because it's critical, it's a basic need. We need to deliver that. Is it possible with the capacity that you've got to achieve that indicator. And then two, you keep on informing us that you love to give advice, but you'll find that at the end of the day, you are not invited or you're not within the process of making decision at that point in time. And then you find that the advice that you're giving, the process is forward and then you're backwards as the SSC. Now, can I also request through you, Chair, that is it possible that the FSCs find itself interacting now and again with an MNE, which is in the president? Because if that relationship gets effective, then because you are the source of the information. You are the source of the information, and that information must be utilized properly. Now, if the MNE is sitting in within the presidency, and what are they basing their monitoring and evaluation on? If the FSC is sitting on the other corner and then are sitting on the other corner, and the budget needs to be allocated, and there is no coordination. Lastly, Chair, thank you, Mtunga Mubuti, Baba, ni the show obviously that provincial profitable share you are taking care of.
Dealing tomorrow with Treasury, so we can put that question again tomorrow. Informali, closing remarks.
I don't have much to say, but you can see there's one of the issues that has been raised, acting chair, about the commissioners. Obviously, we don't expect respond for your own existence. It's a matter that this committee will take forward. Because you derive your mandate from the Constitution. And therefore, we are a very important body. In fact, if you process and trace the history of the financial system, why it was important for you to be in existence at the time. You recall that in 1994, when the 3 spheres of government were to be established, there was no precedent anyway in terms of the correct baselines of how to allocate resources. In particular, at the time, it was a challenge between national and provincial governments, let alone the local government. But with time. Systems have been able to be put in place, there is institutional memory, and there was a debate as to whether the FSC does have a significant role to play moving forward. And that debate was premature in the sense that local government had not yet taken effect and root in our system of governance, which is still the case up to now. And I think there's a debate around that particular matter, whether the division of revenue formula that we are using is adequately covering the policy mandates of the various spheres of government. Policy evolution, national, policy implementation, provincial, and to a certain extent, a larger extent on basic services, local government. So I think it is important that we take the appointments of commissioners very, very serious as a committee on our part. And therefore, those who are appointed should also equally take their responsibilities in a manner that the Constitution envisages them to execute their mandate. Perhaps one of the things that we need to look at as the committee is the mechanism of appointing commissioners. Because you've got provincial nominees, you've got national nominees, and so on and so forth. To what extent does this particular process take into consideration the expertise that is required? But also,
term of existence expires at different, in terms of individual commissioners, at different or lapses at different times. Some in August, some in 2009, some in another year. I don't think there is a sense that there's a body that begins to work as a team. You know, I think we should begin to look into this matter as a committee and make our own recommendations in that regard. The issue of census, you're right that the correct baseline, if 96 to 97% of the division of revenue is based on population, and there's been a lot of migration, not only in terms of rural, urban, within the borders of South Africa. There's guesstimates in terms of what we have in terms of migration, for economic reasons, from the continent into South Africa. What impact does that have in the last 10 years to different provinces? It may not necessarily be rural provinces that are affected. It may be urban provinces with metros and so on and so forth. So I thought I should make this observation so that we have a sense that your recommendations are also informed by an extensive exercise of work amongst yourselves. But and also the issues that are supposed to take your advice and recommendations, they do so with a great measure of responsibility and respect of the work that has been done. I have got my own views in terms of how, you know, the recommendations have been looked at by Parliament as a whole to make sure that, in particular the NCOP, because at the end of the day, as much as the National Assembly has a responsibility in terms of fiscal framework and so on and so forth, but the National Council of Provinces has got a direct responsibility to safeguard the interests of all spheres of government, particularly provinces and local government. That's why issues are challenging to be validated. And therefore, your report is more critical, even at that level. So, Chair, Co-Chair, I thought I should just make this few remarks.
Thank you, Chairperson Somali. Yes. We also facilitated from our side in the NCP regarding the input made last year at the workshop given to us by the FFC, a closer relationship and follow-up message to provinces by the FFC. I know the Northern Cape at the workshop a few weeks ago. So that process is also in place. That's part of our oversight over the provinces. I noted you, Mr. Kumalo.
I just wanted to say I want to agree quite strongly with the sentiments that have been expressed by both Honorable Madlamini and Honorable Mufamadi. At the Commission, Honorable Mufamadi, you would probably be glad to know that we are in a process where we want to relook at some of the provisions of the FFC Act in terms of what the Commission must actually be doing. That was triggered in part by some discussions that we have had with the Minister of Finance when he actually came on board. He had certain views about the Act itself and what it actually means in practice. And quite a lot of issues that arise relating to relevance and how does government treat these recommendations actually derive from certain provisions in that Act that we must actually be trying to look at and see whether that those provisions are actually still relevant in terms of looking at legislation that was passed after. Because the FFC Act in terms of the IGFR system was one of the first acts that we passed. I think the only one that preceded it is the borrowing powers of provincial government. I don't know why, but borrowing powers was the first one, and then the FFC Act, and then you get then the IGFR Act, and then So in terms of these interactions, one still have to look at that and see whether some of those things are actually still relevant. So we are actually at the commission busy looking at that and looking for legal opinion as well to just to see what how we can take these things forward. In terms of what Honorable Magda means, I can't agree with you more in terms of how we should actually find our position. Basically, we are looking at both the M&E and also the Planning Commission, because most of the things that we do at the FFC are actually long-term. And if you think about things like infrastructure decisions on financing infrastructure, depending on the size of the infrastructure project, those will have to form quite a key part of what the Planning Commission does, and where does the IGFR aspect come in that? I will tell you that I went to the Eastern Cape in August, early August, to table the recommendations for next year's process. And one of the key issues that was raised was investment in infrastructure in this country is heavily skewed to the developed provinces at the expense of the smaller provinces. So I took a step back and I thought about how much money we talk about that were put into infrastructure and the vehicles that we're using for that. Our state-owned enterprises like your Transnet, your ESCOMs, and the focus of their projects, the major projects that they are involved in, is not evenly spread across countries, across provinces or across the country. So there are certain provinces that have an unfair share, that is the story that comes out of that, that have an unfair share of this huge infrastructure investment program into South Africa. So those are issues that at face value, it's not such a big issue. But when you actually think about it in terms of equitable division of revenue, nationally raised revenue, government basically puts in guarantees on some of these projects, and there are secondary implications on the amount available for equitable sharing, because we must have that money that we take out for debt, and it goes on and on. So these are issues that we think that in discussions, if the Commission were to be able to have these kinds of discussions on a regular basis with the Planning Commission, for example, it actually can make quite a big difference in terms of how we strengthen the intergovernmental dynamic in the whole process. And those are some of the things that I have been tasked with in the next period that we are entering as a, of the Commission. So thank you very much, Chairperson, for an engaging discussion that we've had.
Thank you, Mr. Kumalo, for your presentation from the FSC side. Thank you to all the members for your participation, the rest of the officials. We meet again tomorrow as a committee, the two Select Committee on Finance and Standing Committee on Finance, 9:30, in the Kuda Chamber, where we will be dealing with National Treasury and such annual reports. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Make sure you don't touch your name, because this is a list I'm giving. Are you on this personally, or are you new?
I'm Susan.
I thought I'd pick you up on that. I thought I'd call you something else.
No, I call myself Martha.
Martha.
Okay. Yes, I'm going to go to the next one. 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 I'm going to go to the